content of this program is for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to another edition of Salute a Veteran Every Day. Salute a Veteran Every Day is underwritten by RBR Physical Therapy. Are you in pain or discomfort? Start your journey of relief at RBR Physical Therapy, located at 1300 Corporation Parkway, Suite B, Raleigh. Call 919-917-7729. Or visit us at www.rbrpt.com. Limp in, leap out. Well, today my guest is Steve Wilson. Full disclosure, we've been friends for many, many years and starting working at Colonial Stores Grocery. And if anybody remembers Colonial Stores in Raleigh, they're as old as us, Steve. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank.
And then we went on to NC State together. You were a couple years ahead of me. You went to NC State and then Air Force ROTC, and then you went in the Air Force a couple years ahead of me. Steve, let me turn it over to you and tell us a little about, if you want, starting with Vietnam or wherever you'd like to start.
Well, I spent 24 years total in the military, and like most career military folks, moved around a lot. Mm-hmm. So I started off in pilot training in South Texas, Laredo Air Force Base, right on the border with Mexico, and that took about a year. We started off with 80 second lieutenants. We graduated 50. Probably the hardest thing I've ever done in my life.
Flight school?
Flight school. Mm-hmm. Very difficult. Every day is a new challenge, and you have very little time to master those challenges.
Mm-hmm.
And I struggled, but I got through.
You got through.
So I was happy about that. And it was funny. My father had told me to go into ROTC at NC State, so he had been a World War II vet. And he could see that Vietnam was going to be a problem when I graduated from high school in 1965. Vietnam was really becoming an issue. And
mm-hmm.
he said, well, you need to go into ROTC so you can, if you go to Vietnam, at least you'll be an officer then.
Mm-hmm.
And I followed his advice. After pilot training was over, I ended up volunteering for an assignment that sent me to Vietnam. So I got to Vietnam in June of 1971.
Mm-hmm.
After lots of training, about the previous year, year and a half before that, I was in the training mode.
Pilot training,
and then learning how to fly a new airplane, survival school.
Where was pilot training?
Pilot training was at Laredo Air Force Base, and then I went to Hurlburt Field in Florida for a couple of months right after I got married.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to survival school right before I left for Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in Fairchild Air Force Base, Washington. That was just a two-week-long basic survival school.
And that's pretty tough, too, isn't it?
Yeah, it's physically demanding. You do spend about 5 days out in the woods with not very much food, but it's not that hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't want people to die doing it or starve to death. But, yes, you're hungry when you're finished.
You hang in there.
Yes. So I went to the Philippines for a couple of weeks, waiting on a slot to open up for Jungle Survival School, which is only about 3 or 4 days long. But that's a requirement before you went to Vietnam, was to have survival school in the Philippines. So you'd be ready for the jungle if you had to bail out of an airplane. And your tour starts officially when you land in the Philippines. So people are not in a hurry to get to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, everybody else, I was not in a hurry.
Burn up
so
some
I enjoyed
time.
Those 2 weeks. Most of it was vacation time.
Burn up some time at Clark Air Base.
Yes. Yeah. So I ended up in Vietnam mid-June of 71. And, of course, more training. You have to get local training and all, and that took not too long, a couple of days. And then they sent me to my final base, which was Pleiku Air Base, Vietnam. And I'm sure most people don't know where that is. It's in the Vietnam is divided into four military regions, with the area closest to the DMZ was Military Region 1, and that's where Da Nang is and other places you may have heard of, like mm-hmm. the Citadel, which was popular during the Tet Offensive
mm-hmm.
Under attack. And Military Region 2 is where Pleiku is located. And it's not far from the Laotian border and also the Cambodian border.
Mm-hmm.
Our unit was strictly flying what we called out country. So we were working with aircraft, fighter aircraft, mostly from the United States, trying to interdict the supplies that were coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Laos and Cambodia.
And what were you flying?
I was flying in those days the O2.
Mm-hmm.
And the O2 is the military version of the Cessna 337.
Mm-hmm.
So it has two engines, weighs about 4,000 pounds, very lightly armed. We had rockets, I think it was 7 rockets on each wing, and we could mark targets with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so our job was to locate targets on the ground and then mark them with one of these rockets. And the rocket was filled with white phosphorus smoke, which is really easy to see from 20,000 feet where the fighters are. So we're down low to the ground, locating trucks, tanks, bulldozers, troops occasionally, supplies out in the open or things that were camouflaged, and occasionally anti-aircraft guns.
And you're marking that for the fighters.
For the fighters. And then they come
in. They're going
in,
so fast, they...
They can't. They have trouble seeing small things on the ground. And so the enemy generally does not shoot at that spotter plane too much. But once you roll in to mark them, they say, oh, the game's over. They know where we are. Then they start shooting back.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they're shooting at the fighters because they're dropping bombs on them.
Yeah.
So, and that mission is very exciting. It's a good mission for a lieutenant right out of pilot training. You know, if you go to something like a transport, you're the co-pilot. You're not in charge. But this particular job, you know, I was the only person in the airplane most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I flew most of my missions in northeastern Cambodia. And the real action was not there. There mm-hmm. were supplies that were being moved through there on the way to South Vietnam on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, but it was very quiet, and we did not see a lot of action there. And, you know, if you're over there, you want to make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a one-page letter in the what we call the ready room, where people would kind of gather before going to fly. And this letter explained a classified mission. And I'm thinking, wow, this sounds like Terry and the Pirates from, you know, the early 1950s.
Right.
It sounded kind of exciting, but it really didn't give a lot of details. And I thought, well, I don't have any of the prerequisites for this, but I'll volunteer anyway. And lo and behold, they accepted me because they had so many losses that they needed to backfill the vacancies. And so I showed up, and that was about halfway through my year in Southeast Asia. I went back to Raleigh to see my bride.
Mm-hmm.
We got married right before I left for Vietnam. And when I left, I think we'd been married like 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
And so we came back to Raleigh halfway through my tour. And then when I went back to Vietnam, I showed up in my new assignment. This assignment was really, really cool. And as I got into it, I showed up at a base in Thailand. And I was assigned permanently to this base in Thailand. Udorn, Thailand was the name of the base. It was about 30 miles from Laos. And they maintained our personnel records. We were assigned to that squadron in Thailand, but that I only spent one day there in Thailand. And they gave me the best military orders that you can get. They were 179-day temporary duty orders to Laos.
Mm-hmm.
Except it didn't say Laos, because Laos was a classified location.
Yeah, I was going to say at that time
we weren't supposed to be. We had very few official military in Laos. And so the order said TDY from Udorn to Bangkok, which is the capital of Thailand, and other such places as required. Variations authorized. And for military people that are listening, they'll know that this is like license to steal.
That's right.
So I show up at the my new place in Laos, and I flew into the country. I had to leave all of my military gear in Thailand, and they locked it up in this big steel box called a Connex. All my uniforms were in there. The only thing military I took with me was my Air Force ID card, my Geneva Convention card, and dog tags.
Mm-hmm.
and everything else was confiscated. Oh, and my boots were military issue boots, but those were so prevalent all over that was not uncommon to find people. And this was to allow, if you got captured by the North Vietnamese, this would allow the government to have deniability that you were not really part of the military. And this is what in the trade craft of spying and all is called sheep dipped, when you're stripped of one identity and thrust into a new identity. So I was sheep dipped from being a lieutenant in the Air Force into working with the CIA. And I've got to say it was a really cool assignment, mm-hmm. although very dangerous.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds very dangerous.
It was extremely dangerous. Over the course of a five-year period, there were about 165 pilots that flew this mission, and I believe it was 31 were killed. And if you do the math on that, it's a pretty high loss rate. Yeah. And almost everybody that flew that mission had at least one or more close brushes with death, including those 31 that were killed in action. Mm-hmm. So it was a very dangerous mission. And I know when I finished my little local checkout program there in a brand new airplane, I had to learn to fly a new airplane in like 4 days. And then the next thing you know, I'm
same model.
No, this was a new airplane. Uh-huh. This was a different airplane. It was the civilian designation is the Cessna 180. It's a single-engine plane that was left over from the Korean War. It used to be flown by the Army, and they called it the L-19. The Air Force called it the O-1. Very lightly armed, had a weight of about a ton, about 2,000 pounds. When I took my wife and kids down to Hurlburt to show them the airplane that I flew, everybody was kind of like, is this it? You know, it's just a very small, very primitive, no technology at all. We were down there to dedicate a memorial to people that had flown the mission I flew in Southeast Asia, and everybody was looking at these planes, you know, mm-hmm. and wondering how we got through that, including us. I did that for 6 months, and it was really very challenging, hard work. They wanted people that were willing to break the rules. We did have a top secret rules of engagement that we had to take a test on. Every day they would meet with air attaché, would meet with the ambassador, the U.S. ambassador to Laos, and they had strict marching orders, you know, and they were coordinating with the CIA what they wanted to do the next day. And, of course, I was just a lowly lieutenant, and those meetings were attended by lieutenant colonels and up. So I was just down in the trenches with the other 10 pilots that were doing this at my location. And every morning we would have a schedule. We lived, when I first got there, the town that we were supposed to be operating from had been overrun by the North Vietnamese, and it was not safe for having airplanes. They backed us up and left us in the capital city of Vientiane. So every morning the first thing we had to do was take off and fly for about an hour just to get to our operating area.
Where were your airplanes? Were they
the airplanes were located in Vientiane at the civilian airport.
Uh-huh.
I remember one time when I came back at the end of a long day, we typically flew about four missions a day, and that's a lot of combat flying.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, many, many hours, sometimes over 10 hours of flying. The days were really long.
Where was your mind in this mission? Were you, you know, at that young age?
Yes.
It was probably pretty exciting on the one hand.
It was very exciting, and probably more than I had signed up for or thought I was getting into. But, you know, you rise to the challenge, and people that get into the military, you know, when you're assigned a job to do, you want to do the best you can. You know, people in high places, you know, the president himself was seeing the results of what we were doing, mm-hmm. and was briefed on what we were doing. So it was a lot of responsibility for lieutenants.
We got through it. That was under President Nixon. Did the politics get involved at all? Or?
Well, there were a lot of politics involved because they had decided, going all the way back to the Kennedy administration in the 60s, that Laos was one of the linchpins in Southeast Asia. And they had this theory called the domino theory, that if one country fell, all of them were going to fall. You know, we were, the politicians were real concerned about Laos because Laos was this backwoods, very unsophisticated country. You know, they didn't have very much technology. For example, we gave them several million dollars to extend the length of one of the runways. They took that money and they built a new monument downtown to Buddha. And we call that the vertical Buddha, because that was the runway that we were supposed to have somewhere. That was the politics involved. For me personally, and I think this is common for young people in any job, you don't think you're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
You always think it's going to be the other person. I guess I had that same idea. I had two or three very close brushes with death. And the first one happened, we had about 25,000 North Vietnamese regulars. And if you're familiar with the Vietnam War, you know that they had some North Vietnamese regulars, but a lot of the fighting was done by the Viet Cong, who were basically part-time soldiers and full-time farmers. These were North Vietnamese regulars, and they had one of their best generals, and his job was to try and take over this location where the CIA had their headquarters in Laos. And that's where I was supposed to have been assigned, but just a few weeks before I showed up, the North Vietnamese had sent troops into town, and they held them off, but they were just right on the other side of the mountain. So the North Vietnamese were literally less than 10 miles from this base.
Mm.
And so when I had my first close brush with death, they had a hill, and on the top of this hill, they had an anti-aircraft gun. And this anti-aircraft gun took out many a pilot and crew. I was one of the people that was hit by this gun, and it was a 14.5 millimeter bullet. To get that in perspective, if you hold your thumb up, that's about the size of the bullet that hit my airplane, a little bit over a half an inch in diameter. That's not a small projectile.
No.
And the anti-aircraft gun would alternate the rounds. They would have one tracer round so that the crew could see what direction the shells were mm-hmm. going. And then they would have a armor-piercing round, and when that hit something, it would blow up. And then the last type, the third round, was an incendiary round. So what hit me was that third round, the incendiary round, and it hit the prop very close to the hub on the prop.
Yeah.
It exploded. And the shrapnel went into the engine compartment. But oddly enough, the engine kept running and the prop didn't leave the airplane.
Mm.
We did not fly with parachutes, did not have ejection seats. You know, if we got hit, we were just going to have to dead stick it in and land somewhere. Of course, the plane was very slow. I flew back home and I got out of that. And the guy that was in my back seat was the same guy that was with me when the second time I had a near brush with death. And the second time, we were still looking for this gun. This gunner was so good, he killed a bunch of crew members. And so we had a two-plane team. I was the low plane, and I was down low drawing the fire of the gun. And the guy that was up high was supposed to be trying to locate the gun because he could see those tracers.
Mm-hmm.
That's the disadvantage of tracers. The gun crew can see where the tracers are going and adjust their fire.
So
but the people up high can see it and go back to where it started from and see where the gun is.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, I got hit again. And this time it was by an armor-piercing round, and it hit the engine and it killed the engine. So here I am.
You're low.
I'm low, hit, no power, and I'm behind enemy lines about 10 miles. It was not a good situation at all. And on top of that, the weather in Southeast Asia during the dry season, that's when they burn off the fields in preparation for planting their rice for the wet season.
Mm-hmm.
So the visibility when they're burning off the fields is very low. And, of course, we knew the area very well because we were out there all the time. But you couldn't see more than maybe a mile, mile and a half,
which
is terrible.
Did that help hide you at all?
Well, it would help hide you because they could know what direction you're going in, but they wouldn't be able to see you for very long. So I immediately started heading. I had a choice of two places to land. And I knew the safest place to land was that CIA base because there were a lot of friendlies there, and I would be safe there. The problem is there was a mountain between where I was and the field, and that mountain range was called the Skyline Ridge, and it's famous because that's where this battle was taking place, was on that Skyline Ridge. The North Vietnamese troops kept going up there trying to take that ridge line over. Because in military world, the higher ground is where you want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been a perfect place to be attacking that town. And so I headed, I didn't want to go to that other field. I wanted to go to that CIA base because the other field was under continuous siege.
Now, there were CIA some CIA base. That's
it was
different.
Also a CIA base, but there were only like two people there.
But that's different than the civilian base where you were.
Yeah, these were totally military bases, okay. And the CIA was really sneaky. The location where the headquarters was located, all the fields in Laos had numbers, and they were called Lima sites for Laos sites. Mm-hmm. So LS for short. So the CIA place was Long Chin. That's where their headquarters was. And it was Lima Site 20 alternate. So the other place I could have gone to was Lima Site 20, which was only about 5 miles away.
Mm-hmm. But you have no power.
I had no power. So I couldn't go to one and then go to the other. I had to make a decision of which to go to.
Do you remember what your altitude was?
I was probably, the mountains there were up to like even 7 or 8,000 feet in places. And I remember this gun was located on Hill 1800, which is 1800 meters, which is over 5,000 feet. So I was probably like 7 or 8,000 feet myself, but some of the mountains were taller than me.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the light airplanes like I was in do glide pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
So I headed for friendlies, and I just barely cleared that skyline ridge by maybe 100 feet. And then I landed at the base a few minutes later, and I was very happy. And I looked, I forgot to mention that we usually flew with Laotian Army officers in the back seat because they would talk to their people on the ground and help us adjust the fighter strikes. Mm-hmm. And I looked in the back after we got on the ground. The tower said, push that airplane off the runway. We've got people that need to take off. And these were CIA airplanes, mm-hmm. Air America airplanes that needed to go drop supplies for people. And so they told us to push it off. So we pushed the airplane off the runway. And, of course, it's very light.
Yeah.
It didn't weigh much. And I told the backseater, I said, well, are you ready to go fly again? And he said, oh, yeah, our Buddha is strong. We're not going to die today. And I laughed. I said, well, they're not going to let us fly again today. Our plane is not going to work. And we laughed about that. And that same guy was in my airplane both times.
Both times.
And I've been able to link up with that guy. He escaped Laos as a refugee in the late 1970s, spent a bit of time in Thailand in a refugee camp, and he lives up in Michigan. He's in his 80s, and I was able to link up with him through Facebook, believe it or not.
That is awesome.
And he came to Raleigh a couple of years ago and visited with us with two of his children, so that was a lot of fun.
Why don't we make a long-term proposal to have him and you again?
That'd be great. His health is not great.
Well, our time is up, and Steve, I think we could have you two or three times on Salute a Veteran Every Day. But, my friend, I salute you. As I reach over the monitor, I salute you and thank you for your service, putting your life on the line. And we're fortunate to have people of your caliber in our Air Force.
Thank you very much.
Now, Steve, what about that third brush with death you had?
Well, I was out in the area flying, and we wanted to see what was going on right at the North Vietnamese border. Laos is right adjacent to North Vietnam. And, of course, the Ho Chi Minh Trail exits from North Vietnam close to our area. And I wanted to go over and see what was going on because we knew that they were moving troops from this one area to a new area. So I wanted to fly over there. Well, I got over there and we looked at the area. There really wasn't much we could see because the weather was moving in. So we only had about 4 hours of fuel, and I knew it was going to take me I've estimated about an hour to get back to my home base. So my fuel situation was really grim. This airplane, as I mentioned, was an older airplane, and the fuel gauge was literally a cork that was floating in the fuel in the wing. And that was hooked to a lever that we could see in the cockpit. So as long as that lever was bouncing around, because you're always moving around in an airplane, so as the fuel would shift around in the wing, that lever would bounce around some. Well, I had so little gas left that the lever was not bouncing at all. So I knew I was down to what we would call fumes. And I hoped that I was going to get on the other side of that mountain and have a chance at least of getting back home. And we turned around and started heading home. And as happens with flying, things don't always happen the way you plan. And there was quite a bit of a headwind. So I had arrived at my area close to North Vietnam quickly, but going back home was taking too long. And the weather was getting worse and worse and worse. The cloud cover was picking up. And this plane I was flying was not an instrument-rated airplane. It was Korean War vintage, pretty much clear weather type airplane. And I got back about 15, 20 minutes from my home base, and the clouds went down and touched the mountains. Well, I need to get on the other side of the mountains. So I thought, well, I don't want to crash here because this is bad guy country. So I just pulled back on the stick, flew up into the clouds. I popped up into the clouds, which I knew was above the treetop. This is what we call a saddle, where you've got rising terrain on the left and the right. Mm-hmm. So I was going to fly through this saddle to get to the other side. Mm-hmm. And then drop down into the valley on the other side. So I was trying to cross that mountain. So I just took a chance.
Where did you get the lift to be able to go up?
Well, it was not a problem. I mean, that airplane had some power, not a lot of power. So we just pulled back on the stick to climb maybe 50 or 100 feet. Mm-hmm. And then push over on the stick on the other side. And we got to safety. I made it.
You can laugh now.
I can laugh now. It was not funny at the time, but, you know, life is full of risk, and I took a chance, and I got by. If it had happened another day, maybe I wouldn't have been so lucky.
Well, I don't know if it was luck, and I don't know if it was a chance. I think it was the culmination of your aeronautical knowledge and skill.
Maybe so.
Thanks so much for sharing with us today, Steve. It's been great.
Thank you, Frank.
And that wraps up today's edition of Salute a Veteran Every Day. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast on our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Salute a Veteran Every Day is underwritten by RBR Physical Therapy. Are you in pain or discomfort? Start your journey of relief at RBR Physical Therapy, located at 1300 Corporation Parkway, Suite B, Raleigh. Call 919-917-7729 for information, or visit www.rbrpt.com. Limp in, leap out. And address any comments that you may have for us, as usual, at 919-832-5138. I'm Frank Urban for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. See you again next time for Salute a Veteran Every Day.